Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name's Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
And I'm Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiologist and researcher here at Queen's, and I'm the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we call TIME. And we're sitting here in the lovely studio of CFRC, 101.9 FM. And I should mention, this was here when I was a student back in the dark ages, and it was actually here in 1922, one of the older radio stations, I think, in the world.
Yeah, at that time you were using a tablet, but actually you were using also a mallet.
It was the original tablet.
That's right.
Thank you, Charlie. You're fired.
In this series, we are fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished translational researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to know what their dangerous idea is, which is a concept that they're working on, which, if true, would change the direction of their research or alter our understanding of medicine. But we also want to find out a little bit about the person behind these discoveries. In previous podcasts, we sat down with clinicians and basic scientists from Queen's and beyond to discuss a diverse range of research topics, ranging from cancer research, studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorders, and the impact of animal care on human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
Today, we're so lucky to have Dr. Sanoj Chacko visit us today in the studio. Sanoj is an associate professor here at Queen's University in the Department of Medicine. He's in the Division of Cardiology, and he's a special type of cardiologist. Of course, we cardiologists all think we're special types, but he is an adult electrophysiologist, and he's the director of our Adult Electrophysiology Fellowship Program, which trains future electrophysiologists. And these doctors deal with the electrical wiring of the heart and getting rid of heart rhythm problems. So, Dr. Chacko, thank you for arranging coverage today. I think Victor's covering for you. Appreciate you coming off service to talk to us about your research and your clinical work. But before we get too far into the world of electrophysiology, can you tell me your backstory? How did you wind up at Queen's University, and how did you become an electrophysiologist?
First of all, thank you so much for having me today. It's a privilege for me to be here today. Looking back to your life is always very nostalgic. I'm from South India, a state called Kerala. It's a very beautiful state known for its natural beauty, backwaters, and cultural diversity. So I was born there, and then I moved to a place called Chennai. It's called previously known as Madras. It's a beautiful city, metropolitan city, where I spent most of my childhood. And then I did my medical school in Kilpak Medical College. And then once I completed my medical school, I moved to United Kingdom, where I had the opportunity to do my residency, internal medicine and cardiology. And I had a lot of mentors who had helped me to progress into my career towards cardiology, Dr. LMR, Dr. Vernon Clark, Dr. Sanjeev Petkar. And then I had the opportunity to do my cardiology training program in the West Midlands Deanery, which is one of the big deaneries in the United Kingdom. And I had a wonderful mentors to train me in cardiology and in cardiac electrophysiology, specifically Dr. Marshall and Dr. De Bono, who helped me to focus more in cardiac electrophysiology, and then head towards a fellowship program, which I had the opportunity to come to Kingston, a wonderful place again. And I did my fellowship in 2016 in cardiac electrophysiology, such a beautiful place in Canada. And eventually I ended up in Kingston, had a job at Queen's University, and now I'm in Kingston. So in summary, I had the opportunity to be in the best part of all worlds so far. And I enjoyed my time.
Yeah. We're very glad you're here. And it's interesting, it's kind of a full circle thing for you, because you came to Kingston largely because you did your fellowship here. And I think Dr. Redfern and others were instrumental in getting you here. And then now you're the fellowship program director, and you're training the incoming people that may be future faculty members.
That's correct, yeah. And it's a great opportunity to be the fellowship program director, because it's a wonderful opportunity to train people in cardiac electrophysiology. And so far, it has been a great experience, yeah.
So you're now the mentor of up-and-coming electrophysiologists. What about the kind of mentorship that you received along your path here?
My mentorship, you know, my training here was absolutely fantastic. I had the opportunity to work with, you know, get trained by Dr. Redfern, Dr. Simpson, and all other cardiac electrophysiologists here. And it has been a fantastic experience, a great learning curve. I had the opportunity to evolve myself as an electrophysiologist since being in the Queen's University.
And it's interesting, we were talking to Chancellor, who's our podcast guru and recording studio expert today, and he was amazed that there are jobs like electrophysiology. It is a very niche specialty, very important, but it's, I don't think most people even understand it. So when I say electrophysiologist to a layperson, what should I be telling them? What do you actually do for a living?
Oh, we do a lot of work in cardiac electrophysiology, which involves dealing with arrhythmias, which could be atrial fibrillation, very common arrhythmias, atrial flutter, ventricular fibrillation, ventricular arrhythmias.
So all of these things are electrical issues?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so maybe tell me a little bit more about how these electrical issues contribute towards these pathologies.
For example, atrial fibrillation is one of the commonest arrhythmia that we see in general practice. And atrial fibrillation affects majority of the population, regardless of their age, although we see that very commonly in elderly population. Atrial fibrillation causes erratic functioning of the heart. It, you know, the heart starts to beat very in an erratic manner, causing dyssynchronous and uncoordinated contraction of the heart.
And that, those contractions are driven by some electrical stimulus.
That's correct. So living with atrial fibrillation is not easy because, you know, there are a number of, it's a disabling problem, and people deal with different symptoms. Some people feel that they have racing heartbeat, they feel breathless, chest pain, feeling tired and lethargic, and a very poor quality of life. And about 10 to 15% of the people, they don't feel any symptoms at all whatsoever. And it's an incidental finding for those group of people. So the consequence of atrial fibrillation can be devastating if left untreated. For example, when atrial fibrillation occurs, the top chambers of the heart, what we call as atria, contracts in an erratic fashion. Therefore, it doesn't squeeze all the blood to go into the bottom chamber of the heart. As a result, you have pooling of blood in the top chamber of the heart. That results in formation of clot in the top chambers of the heart, and which then migrates to the rest of the body, causing, if it migrates to the brain, it can cause a stroke, or rest of the body can cause devastating complication. So the primary goal of treating atrial fibrillation is to minimize the risk of complication, particularly to minimize the risk of clot formation and migration of clot. And therefore, we treat people with blood thinners to minimize this complication, which is devastating. And the further treatment, again, is focused on how we can improve their quality of life, improve their symptoms, and get rid of atrial fibrillation if at all possible. And there are a number of ways of doing it. You could treat with medications, but over last two decades at least, catheter ablation has been the cornerstone for treatment of atrial fibrillation.
It's kind of interesting because when I was a young doctor, the first trials came out about atrial fibrillation. You mentioned it can be asymptomatic, and those trials were called acronyms like SPAF, S-P-A-F, and SPINAF. But anyway, they were big cooperative studies that looked at the CT scans of the brains of people with AFib. And those studies discovered something which was actually quite shocking, that if you had atrial fibrillation, you had a 4 to 5-fold increase in your likelihood of having a silent stroke compared to people your same age and sex that didn't have AFib. So that's when we began to know it was a problem. And then there were other studies that followed that showed that blood thinners work. And then along comes the idea of ablating atrial fibrillation and getting rid of it. And this has really become a growth industry now that there are Apple Watches everywhere, because a lot of times it's not being discovered by a doctor anymore. It's being discovered by the patient when their watch says, hey, you've got atrial fibrillation. So I just have to ask you, putting on my layperson hat, are those watch diagnoses of AFib accurate?
The watch diagnosis of atrial fibrillation gives you some information about that your heart is erratic. People often appreciate that the synchronous contraction of the heart is being lost. And then it is a simple form to determine whether you have a normal heart rhythm or not. But it's not always accurate because we need ECG characterization to be absolutely sure what type of rhythm a person has. Is it atrial fibrillation or is it atrial flutter? Or is it actually what you call as a supraventricular tachycardia, which can be of all different types? Essentially, the management is tailored according to the type of arrhythmia.
So just following on for that and for our audience and for anybody who isn't an electrophysiologist, if my Apple Watch gives me an indication that I have arrhythmia, what should I do?
You should certainly approach your doctor.
Okay, so that's
Are we sponsored by Apple yet? If not, why not?
Other smartwatches exist.
it is interesting because, like, sometimes what I see in my cardiology practice is the warning is basically a lot of premature atrial beats or a lot of artifact. But it's not bad for detecting some type of heart rhythm problem coming from the atrium as an entree to seeking medical attention.
Certainly, yeah. Certainly it's helpful to seek medical attention, and that's what we would recommend, seeking medical attention. We need ECG characterization to be absolutely sure of the type of arrhythmia, which is crucial in management of, or in delivering the management of atrial fibrillation specifically.
And it's interesting, an EKG, for people that have never had one, I mean, it's a non-invasive recording, won the Nobel Prize for a guy named Einthoven, how to record electricity from the human heart. So that was the disruptive or dangerous idea of the 1800s,
yeah,
is that the heart generated electricity. We now take that for granted, but that's a pretty cool idea that led to EKGs being, and now we wear our EKGs on our wrists with a watch. But it is a pretty amazing evolution of a field of science from very basic to very applied. And an EKG, as you were saying, to characterize it, I think the bill for getting an EKG is something like, I don't know, $10 or $12. It's pretty discounted test in the Ontario healthcare system.
Well, since you mentioned dangerous ideas, on this show, we like to ask researchers about their dangerous ideas, which is something that you're working on, which is so disruptive, it might change your field of study. What's your dangerous idea?
So being an electrophysiologist, we've been always we've been always involved in catheter ablation. So catheter ablation is...
Just walk me through that. A catheter obviously is like a long straw that you can insert into the body. Maybe just start there and...
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So catheter ablation is a procedure performed under deep sedation or under general anesthesia. And we give freezing in the groin and we access a blood vessel in the groin and we put advanced, little catheters that goes inside your heart. We call it catheters for the tube, so it would go inside your heart.
You pass it all the way up through the body, right into the heart.
Right into the heart, yeah. And then once we go inside the heart, then we will target areas inside the upper chamber of the heart where atrial fibrillation comes from. And the idea is to do a three-dimensional mapping of the heart at that point and then trying to determine the source of atrial fibrillation most of the time. And the pulmonary veins, we call little veins in the left top chamber of the heart, are the excitable areas where the atrial fibrillation comes from. But of course, there are other areas where the atrial fibrillation can come from as well. So the catheter ablation is, we deliver thermal energy either by means of radio frequency, by means we deliver heat energy, or we could do what we call as a cryoablation, which is a freezing technique where we freeze the tissues to less than minus 40 degrees, and then we cause little scars inside the top chamber of the heart to get rid of the atrial fibrillation. So the catheter ablation has evolved over several decades, and there are a number of safety mechanisms, the success rate, the efficacy of the catheter ablations using thermal energy source has been, has evolved. The efficacy and the safety has been well established. But it comes with an inherent risk of collateral damages, and that is often, can sometimes be very devastating. Although the risk is extremely low, but it still has a small risk of damage to the collateral structures when we do the catheter ablation in the left top chamber of the heart.
I think for people that have never studied cardiac anatomy, which I would imagine is most of the people listening, you can imagine a small box-shaped structure, which is the left atrium that sits on top of the left ventricle. And those pulmonary veins you mentioned are four tubes that come into the back of the left atrium. They bring in the oxygenated blood from the lung. And you're making little burn marks or freezer marks little, they're not microscopic, but they're the size of the tip of the catheter, which would be like the lead of a pencil. Burn, 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 or freeze, 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 and you're going around. But there's the left atrium sits in a very congested neighborhood, and I hate to make militaristic analogies, but the neighborhood, as you said, gets that collateral damage. And what's in the neighborhood of the left atrium that you're worried when you're consenting someone for one of these procedures? What are the risks that they're taking if they do this procedure?
Yeah, so very important and interesting question. The left top chamber of the heart particularly is in close proximity to the gullet, esophagus we call. And there are also other structures like nerves, like phrenic nerve, which supplies to the diaphragm. And of course, you know, we take a lot of precautions to minimize the damage to these structures because damaging these structures, although it's very rare, could be disabling and also devastating. Particularly as electrophysiologists, we are all very concerned about doing radiofrequency ablation or cryoablations to the back wall of the heart because that is in close proximity to the gullet. And damage to the gullet can be life-threatening.
Yeah, so the swallowing tube, which is, I think, again, when you study cardiac anatomy, it is interesting. I mean, literally, your swallowing tube is right at lays in contact with the left atrium. So your heart and your stomach, the tube leading to your stomach, are touching each other, which is, so it's quite amazing that you can deliver, and this is done safely every day in our hospital and around the world, but that you can 99% of the time deliver that energy without perforating into the swallowing tube or perforating the heart or damaging the nerves that go to the diaphragm. But it's not perfect. And I think that leads us to your dangerous idea, which you told us in advance, and I wrote this down so we get it right, which is pulse field ablation. So what is pulse field ablation and why is that a dangerous idea for the field of electrophysiology?
So pulse field ablation has evolved as an area of immense interest over the past couple of years. There are a number of trials in pulse field ablation. And the basic principle, the fundamental principle of pulse field ablation is what you call as electroporation. That has been used very commonly in gene therapy and for drug treatment, where short impulse of electric field, you know, high voltage electric field is applied to the tissues, and then that results in formation of pores, holes in the cell membrane that cause disruption of the cell membrane. In pulsed field ablation, the intensity of the electric field is slightly higher and titrated in a way so that it can cause irreversible damage to the cell membrane. The concept is very similar, but it's actually in a way that's very the beauty of pulsed field ablation is very tissue specific, and it preferentially targets the area that area of interest. Particularly, if for example for the ablation of atrial fibrillation, it just targets the tissues within the cardiac cells and then doesn't go beyond. So there is no heat energy involved. There is no freezing techniques involved where the heat can go and migrate towards adjacent structures like, you know, nerve or gullet and cause damage. Whereas in pulsed field ablation, it is very preferential and is very tissue specific, and it doesn't go beyond that.
And you were telling us, I think, Sanoj, that different tissues have different sensitivity to this electroporation, to this punching of holes in membranes, so that the esophagus or swallowing tube, that tissue is more resistant to the pulsed energy than, say, the cardiac cells that you're ablating. Is that right?
That's correct. So the reason why it doesn't cause any collateral damage to the adjacent structures, there are a number of reasons. One is because it's a non-thermal source of energy, and secondly, therefore, it doesn't go beyond the tissues that we target, and secondly, different tissues have got different electroporation threshold. For example, like for gullet and pulmonary veins, they've got high electroporation threshold. Therefore, there's a big safety margin as to what a level that we can titrate it just to be more specific towards the cardiac tissue. Therefore, in addition to the complications in the gullet, one of the other complications that we see in conventional thermal ablations is that the narrowing of the pulmonary veins. And all the studies so far has been so promising in pulse field ablation for the last 3 years has been that there had not been any case so far of pulmonary vein stenosis, atrioesophageal fistula, or phrenic nerve injury in pulse field ablation. The Manifest 17K review that was published in Nature showed that of the 17,000 patients who underwent pulse field ablation, none of them had pulmonary vein stenosis or gullet injury or phrenic nerve injury. So which is one of the cornerstone, and that is one of the major reasons why the safety profile is huge. And at least for now, we need long-term data, but at least from the data that we have, although the efficacy is comparable to the thermal ablation, but the most important turning point or the shift towards the current pulse field ablation is because of its safety profile. It has got an improved safety profile, and that's one of the main reasons.
It's interesting, Charlie, in your basic science lab, you use electroporation, but not to ablate AFib, but you use it for gene delivery?
Yeah, punching holes into cells mm-hmm. so that you can have an effective transduction of genes, yeah. A gene payload into a cell so that you can uptake and it can start expressing that
exactly.
gene. So it's the same technology.
Same technology.
In the clinic into a living human to improve kind of efficacy and reduce risk.
That's
and it's also interesting in those cells, and I'm not an expert in electroporation, but I do know that there are different doses or potentials that you have to apply to cells depending on what type of cell it is. So some cells, as I understand it, electroporate easily, and others require more energy.
More fiddly, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So just like the body where the energy that you're applying has a...
Yeah.
tissue specificity at some level. So
that's correct. I think for most of the in most of the studies, the electrical impulse was delivered at around 1,500 volts at a very short pulses, like in microseconds.
And the success rate of this technique, you're saying, doesn't change. So that's about 70% success.
70% for paroxysmals and over 50% for persistence.
Yeah. So that's the same. So you might still have to do it more than once. But the hope or the promise of this disruptive technique would be that you're not going to cause scarring, perforation, or any other badness, or not likely anyway.
Perforation is still a complication that, of course, is how you, we have a lot of, we take a lot of measures to minimize the perforations. There are a lot of safety parameters that we look when we do the ablation. But perforation is something that we, that is always, is very rare complication with all the safety parameters that we use. But the most important safety profile that we, feature or improved safety feature that we see, but that we see for pulse field ablations, that the risk of pulmonary vein stenosis or atrioesophageal fistula has not been seen so far, which is great. You know, that is something that we would like to keep it out of the equation when we take patients for a catheter ablation.
Yeah. And so in terms of this being a disruptive idea, how would medicine change, or how would the field change if this technique were widely available?
I think pulsed field ablation is a milestone in cardiac electrophysiology, and it's a major. We have already seen a big shift in electrophysiology using this technique over the last couple of years. And of course, the catheters are expensive, which is I'm hoping that that will come down, and that will improve, make it available in most of the centers. But I also feel that moving forward, there will be a lot of improvement in. And the type of catheters that we can use, for example, like point-by-point catheters. So that would help, to treat different types of arrhythmias. Now we use the pulse field being treated specifically for atrial fibrillation, but also we could then, I'm seeing that the likelihood is that with improved, with new catheters coming up, we could probably treat ventricular fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia, and other types of arrhythmias in the future.
So great, you've given us a really complex assessment of what you do for your profession and for your research. Can you break it down a little bit and pretend that Dr. Archer and I are high school students and
okay.
explain it to us so that we can understand it?
Okay, thank you. So atrial fibrillation is a very common arrhythmia that you would probably see in your own people, your uncles, aunts, or anybody whom you know very close. So atrial fibrillation is quite disabling disease and has to be treated, and there are different treatment methods. one of the treatments that, as electrophysiologists, that we do is that we have to treat the area where the atrial fibrillation comes from. So we put people to sleep and then access the groin through the blood vessel. There's a big blood vessel in the groin that connects us to the heart. So we put tubes from the groin inside the heart and we burn areas where the atrial fibrillation is coming from. So the old techniques, or the current technique, or traditional way of dealing with atrial fibrillation ablation is by targeting those areas by delivering heat energy or cold energy and then trying to get rid of atrial fibrillation. But that has got an inherent risk of damaging other structures. It's like bombing a place and then you have collateral damages to the rest of the places. But the newer technology, which is evolving and has attracted a lot of electrophysiologists and also the general population, is because the amount of collateral damages as a result of the ablation is very minimal. And therefore, you are able to treat the atrial fibrillation without causing any significant concerns about serious damages that was previously being an issue.
I often think of the electrophysiologist, with no disrespect, like a video gamer in a game like Call of Duty, and you used to have a weapon which was like a bazooka, and you fired it, and yes, you got the target, but you might blow up the building beside the target. And now with this pulsed energy technique, you can have sort of a smart weapon, and it's very precise, and it hits the target, and the amount of so-called collateral damage is pretty small. And that's based on these accurate maps you make, which are like the video game scenario. And then now you've got a better weapon.
That's correct.
That sound about right?
That's correct, Dr. Archer.
Are we paying you to do this? You're just fooling around with
video games. Paying you to play Call of Duty, though?
It's the same amount they were paying me to do this podcast. So, thank you very much. So it's great that you're in Canada and you're an electrophysiologist and a member of the Department of Medicine. So you had a lot of success, but everyone has a bump in the road along the way. And we've talked, Charlie and I, we haven't had any bumps in the road.
No, it's been plain sailing.
Yeah, but we've talked to people that have had troubles in their careers. And so are there any things you've had to overcome that might be interesting to our listeners?
Overall, my career has been quite smooth so far. Of course, we all have ups and downs. But because I was born in a place where there's a lot of cultural differences and, you know, multicultural place, you know, I had the opportunity to have that exposure right from my childhood. And therefore, moving from one place to another, from India to the United Kingdom or from Canada, was not that difficult as an individual. But when we had a family, it was difficult for me, especially moving the whole family from UK to Canada was a challenge because my wife was had a job in United Kingdom. My daughter was 9 at that time. Although I've got 2 little ones after that. So the challenge of moving, although the fellowship was for just for a year, but I had made sure that I bring my family with me at that time. But so my wife has to take sabbatical, and my daughter actually found it very difficult to leave her friends there. So the interesting part is when I came here on the first day, I still remember that my daughter, when we wake up, then my daughter has already written a poem saying that all my life is wasted.
All my life is wasted. I love that. No overreaction whatsoever.
It's funny. I think that you and I actually moved from the UK to Canada at about the same sort of time. I also had 3 kids in tow. My oldest was 8. And so I think kind of a lot of our story resonates. And interestingly, at the time, Inside Out, the movie, came out just after we moved to Canada. And yeah. I just, in line with that, it's like, oh no, because it's that idea where they move this kid out of this happy place into this big city, and then it's a difficult transition, but yeah. Kingston's a beautiful spot.
It's a beautiful spot, yeah.
I lived in Paris for a while, and there was a book my wife Kathy got a hold of called Bloom Where You're Planted, which works more for adults than for children, but that concept, which I think is really hard if you're a kid and there's no secondary gain like a job to actually come to a place, whether it's nice or not does not matter at all. But like your parent has moved you against your will to this new spot, which don't worry, they will eventually forget that. But mine haven't, and they're over 30. So,
well, that reminds me of the old adage: the grass is actually always greener where you water it. So yeah. It's from the same root, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on to our last formal question, which is our time crystal ball, which we bring out for researchers. And when we ask, what direction do you think all of this is going? So we've got these targeted weapons now that we can... Where does your field go from here?
I think pulse field ablation is going to be the future of cardiac electrophysiology. We still need long-term data, but given the research so far has been very promising. And moving forward, I think, you know, catheter ablation is currently being offered as a first-line treatment for people with atrial fibrillation. So I'm very optimistic that, you know, I'm very confident that we can offer the best service to the patients with minimal complications by pulse field ablation technique. And, of course, there will be a lot of technological advances in this area in the future. So I think this is going to be the future. And as electrophysiologists, we are looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be exciting. I know as a referring doctor who finds, and Dr. Chacko does a great job with the patients, I send them off and doing cardioversions, the electrical shock with the paddles that you see on television to convert people back into the regular rhythm. And then I put them on medications, drugs like Sotalol or Flecainide or Amiodarone. And then if they fail that, they go on to ablation. And when I think of why I do it in that stage order at the moment, there's just that little nagging concern about safety. It is a safe procedure, but there are some risks. And so I can imagine that in this future you're envisioning, maybe after we get the person back in the rhythm, we wouldn't be doing the drugs. We would go right on to catheter ablation if we knew it were even safer than it is currently, which is already quite safe. I mean, I think the complication rate is around 2 or 3% of
less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
Yeah. It's so, very safe, yeah.
Good.
Okay, so before we wrap this podcast up, we like our audience to get to know the person behind the research. So we've got a few silly questions arranged for you, which hopefully is going to give people a little bit of a scope and view of who you are. And I'll kick off with one of my favorite questions, which is, what's your favorite meal and can you cook it yourself?
My favorite meal? Oh, good. I wasn't expecting
that. I told you wouldn't expect them.
Yeah, I like meat a lot.
Okay.
So mutton. It would be my favorite, but of course, you know, chicken or anything like that, but mainly mutton.
And do you barbecue it? How do you like it?
No, South Indian, we like to cook in our own way, although we have traveled in different parts of the world, but Asian cooking is slightly different, and we use a lot of spices, and it's a bit complex. But it's very tasty, and everybody likes it.
As a British man, I think most Canadians don't know that actually the official national dish of England is the Indian curry.
It's
the most popular one.
It's tikka masala, maybe.
100%. Or balti, maybe.
So what type of music do you like, and do you play it in the EP lab when you're doing these hours-long procedures?
You know what? I am I'm a musician by, not by profession, but at least by hobby. I do a lot of singing, and I am actually have done a lot of performances, not only in my university, but also in the stages, and also I'm in a platform called Smule, where I do a lot of singing on a regular basis. So I don't play any instruments very well, but I do a lot of vocal singing, yeah.
What kind of music?
South Indian music, yeah.
South Indian music. Yeah. So are you singing while you're ablating, or are you...
some of my colleagues play my music when we do the ablation, yeah.
Oh, really?
Well, wow, can we find you on Spotify?
It's like, instead of being big in Japan, you're big in Kingston.
big in Kingston.
But my challenge would be to, you know, to sing Michael Jackson's, you know.
We won't have you do that.
No, not on this one. Maybe we can invite you back on another podcast.
Of course, yeah. Okay,
so you've moved to Kingston, Ontario. One of the things that I noticed most when I moved here is the importance of the changing seasons.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite season now you're in Canada?
Definitely summer.
Definitely summer.
Yeah.
You like the heat?
Yeah. I like the changing season. You know, it's all beautiful, but summer is my favorite. I believe it's the same for everyone, most of the people at least.
Well, I don't know. I quite like winter. So. I like it when it snows.
You're going to be happier longer than he is.
Yeah.
So if you could travel in time, which direction would you travel, forward into the future or backwards into the past, and why?
forward into the future, because, you know, so far my journey has been quite pleasant, encouraging, supportive, met a lot of nice people in my life, and then I'm anticipating that it's going to be the same moving forward, and I work with great colleagues here, so I'm really looking forward for a bright future.
I love that optimism. Please don't turn on the television set.
No,
don't go too far in the future.
No. Okay, so lastly, my favorite question of all time. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
So I can't go home without saying this. It has to be Pokemon.
Any particular? Is Pokemon one creature or is he?
They're evolved species. Right?
Pokemon is a lot of variety of species. And I just learned it from my son. He's 11 years old now. So he wants me to take him to Japan now to get all the others.
I also have a 13-year-old son who wants me to take him to Japan for exactly that reason. So,
well, good. That sounds very exciting.
Dr. Chacko, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today about your clinical practice. To our listeners, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to get to know Dr. Chacko with us, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University or share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Thank you very much for coming into this.
Thank you so much for having me today. Yeah, thank you.